Hello, welcome to episode 10 of the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're available on rte.ie, iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. You can contact us on Twitter at RTE Rugby or Facebook /RTE Sport. And Paul Wallace is in the room with us, as are Declan Welly and Michael Glennon of the RTE Online Desk and Wes Liddy, producer of Against the Head. And we'll all chime in in a minute, but let's start with what's making the news on the website. Michael, do you want to tell us the headlines?
Yeah, it's mostly post-Champions Cup reaction and probably one of the bigger, wasn't announced at the time, but Jack McGrath moving to Ulster, which was, we'd spoken about it last week as a probable move when we had Eric Miller in here as one of the pioneers of that of travel in that direction. Also, the Johnny Holland coaching column, he's talking about pressure and different types of pressure. He's just saying that normally people associate pressure with individual struggles or a kicker's how he deals with it.
Yeah.
And he's saying that there's obviously different types of pressure, and some teams employ it as an attacking term. Richard Cockerell, Razzie Erasmus are guys who want to play the game, put the other guys under pressure during the game.
Yeah, pressure, I don't know what it means then, because like obviously pressure is when you're camped on your own 5 yard line, or 5 metre line, as they say. But then with the mental pressure, which we're sick of discussing from the Six Nations on. Tell me just a little bit about the atmosphere at the Aviva, because I know, Declan, you were there. The rest of us watched on telly. I'm not sure, Paul, were you there, actually?
I was indeed, yeah.
Were you in the corporate box or were you in the cheap seats? Oh, there are none.
I was for once in the corporate boxes, yeah, but a great viewing spot, great game of rugby.
Atmosphere-wise, tell us, I mean, there was all sorts of kind of, I don't know, are people looking for stories, but there was some Leinster supporter shaking his fist at some Ulster person. I don't know whether there was any comment about history made or anything like that. Did you witness any of that?
I'm sure there may have been one or two over the course of the day, but I actually got down there quite early before the match, and I was just surprised by the sea of white around the stadium. And the narrative all week had been that Ulster were travelling in, you know, hope rather than expectation, but inside the stadium it was building, and it actually created a great atmosphere. And once they got the early try, it seemed to actually transfer onto the players, and you could see the belief really building. And that was quite noticeable. When Ross Byrne missed his first two kicks, it seemed to spur them on even more than even the try. And then conversely, towards the end, just inside the stadium, you really felt when Ulster levelled and John Cooney had that kick to push them ahead, when he missed that, it was very uncharacteristic for a player of his quality from the kicking tee. It just drained somewhat. You could just feel it kind of sapped the Ulster supporters in the stadium. Of course, Leinster went down and put over their kick, and you don't know, Ross Byrne kicking injured when you're level and Ross Byrne kicking when you're 2 points down could have been a completely different situation. But I also think that part of it probably was because I was looking at Leinster's last four games in the Aviva in Europe. They've won by an average of 16 points. So I suppose the supporters are almost getting used to not every game has actually been as hard as we thought it might have been. So the Leinster support also, I think, was a couple of decibels higher than we would have seen for many other games. So it just made for an excellent occasion.
Mm. Yeah, because the Aviva, wonderful structure and all as it is, Paul, to me sometimes is a bit like, no disrespect to Kildare Outlet Centre, but there is a kind of a shopping centre feel to it, unless the game is brilliant.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair enough. There's a lot of people late to their seats, and especially after half time as well, maybe the surfing of the bars could be diluted to a shorter period of time. But as you said, the atmosphere was fantastic, and it was all about Ulster. I had expected Ulster actually to have a big start. I thought with Leinster, not alone the experience they're missing in the back line, but the physicality. And we had Marcel Coetzee, I thought, a massive game. Henderson and McCluskey up the middle. Just physically, they outmuscle them. And, you know, you can move the game on and you can try and develop into this sort of modern all-singing, all-dancing game. But if you're losing contacts, each one of them, which Ulster are winning, it's very hard to win a game. And funnily enough, I think the moment which one player didn't get enough credit was Dave Kearney, and him getting Stockdale's arms so Stockdale couldn't get his two arms together for putting the ball down. Small things like that.
That's an interesting point, because I suppose what what impressed me was the lack of vitriol about the young guy making a mistake. Was it a mistake? I mean, was it an experience?
He should have dived. You know, you see a line there. You could have slid along from a few yards out. Yeah, he learned from it. He's not the first talented player to make an error like that. When you're travelling at that pace, I wouldn't know anything about it from my playing days. But you know, he with his height and everything, strength, he should have just dived in, get in over the line, get it down. Always went two arms. But, you know, you could see he was probably looking for a bit of a fend as well. Carney did very well. Just that little nudge on the arm, I think that put him off a bit.
Do you think it was an unforgivable mistake? Because afterwards there's been a lot of talk of, you know, how culpable was he? And it's been said an unforgivable mistake has been doing the rounds. Would you agree that it was?
I don't think it's unforgivable. It's unforgivable if he does it again. He's only a young player still. Look at all the magical moments he's provided for both Ulster and Ireland.
Exactly. It's unforgivable to use that word, I think. It's bloody.
I think it was Brian O'Driscoll. Maybe the act was unforgivable because apparently he has some history. Nigel Carolan had said previously that at under 20s level, they used to be a bit nervous after he crossed the whitewash because that was his kind of lackadaisical style in dotting down. But I know that Dan McFarland and Ian Henderson and Rory Best all come out and said it wouldn't be his fault at all. But as a player, maybe for someone like Rory Best who might not be back there again, are you thinking, I cannot come out and say it's your fault.
There's always small little things in a game and you can't put it down to one. Okay, that was a glaringly obvious one. I think any kids coming through, you're learning to score a try, it's two hands and dive across the line. You don't go to dot down with one, especially when you're that height, 6'3".
Or especially when you've company. I mean, there's clear blue water between you and the defensive line.
He should clearly have scored that. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. What about your opinion on that, Wes? Because we saw Keith Earls do the season pros finish for Munster, which was, I mean, it was never in doubt that he dropped the ball, but even the way he shaped his body to protect himself as he put down the try in the corner that won Munster the game, experience.
There's not much to talk about, really. He should have dived, he should have slid, you know. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I don't even know if the experience comes into it. If an under-15 player makes that mistake, you probably say it's a mistake. Unforgivable, no. He didn't... he didn't commit a crime or anything. He just dropped a ball. So I wouldn't be going down that road with it. But on the game in general, I think, I don't know, I'd bow to the lads that were there. I was watching it on TV, but it did kind of strike me that the atmosphere, for as loud and raucous as it was, it seemed like more of almost a kind of a party atmosphere than an actual huge tension there. And maybe that comes with a team that has a clear expectancy of winning most of their home games at this point in time. And also I thought the travelling support was a little overblown in terms of 15,000. I mean, they're only coming down from Belfast. There's 15,000 Munster fans in Edinburgh. So if you look back 10 years to other Irish derbies, I think it speaks to the tournament, you know, with fragmented TV rights and things like that. I just don't think amongst the general public it has the profile it had a number of years ago. And again, possibly that's because when Ulster, Munster, Leinster, take your pick, first won it, there was a huge novel to it. But now it's been done by so many times by so many teams. I just don't know if it has the same lustre anymore amongst the wider public beyond the immediate rugby fans.
Paul?
Yeah, well, I think Ulster, the noise they made, obviously buoyed on by the performance by Ulster, which they over the last few years, you know, where they're coming from. One of the things about the Ulster supporters, Ravenhill, you know, they've still been bringing in full houses. I think if Munster and Leinster were playing as badly for a few years, through all the incidents off the pitch as well, you'd wonder would he have had that support. Getting tickets, and I suppose that's the thing, the Aviva now for these club games, you know, all the corporate boxes sold out. It's
Check your calendars. It's phenomenal. Mid-noughties all over again, wasn't it, in terms of this one?
It was quite phenomenal to have that, you know, for...
Did you think in the aftermath, judging by the sound bites from the players and the management on the Ulster side, that there was a level of maybe self-satisfaction that they'd performed and done themselves justice, and maybe that's the next step for this team, is that really you're probably wanting to be coming away from that defeat crushed rather than somewhat satisfied?
I think they would have gone down there thinking, look, we've got a chance if everything goes right. Everything didn't go right. We mentioned the Stockdale incident. But if you looked at areas of concern, you know, their scrum, okay, one bad penalty, but generally stood up. It was an, you know, throughout the side, their confidence, the. I would have said they came along saying, right, this is a building block to next season to drive on and maybe the, you know, the Pro 14, it's the qualification there. I think that's the next step. If they can get in there, get into playoffs, give Rory Best a nice sign off if he doesn't play next season. I know that's unconfirmed as of yet. But they're moving in the right direction, and I think that's great.
I hadn't thought of this before you said that, but like I remember the moving in the right direction argument for years with Ulster. Remember they made a final after beating Munster. They were in a Pro 14 final. They had even better players, arguably, seasons ago. And, you know, Pienaar was in his pomp, etc. And they never closed the deal. And now they kind of nearly got a kind of an unexpected chance to push it. What's wrong with it? They're star-crossed in a bad way.
Well, they don't seem to be producing enough players to their academy. You know, 7 players from Leinster were involved, 5 starters, 2
and
on the bench.
And Jack McGrath on the way now,
Jack
as we McGrath were saying.
On the bench. Now, I think that's a very positive thing for Irish rugby. I think there needs to be more movement around the
pro- Seems to be happening,
Someone who moved from Munster to Leinster and have never been quite forgiven down south for it.
We'll get into that.
It is only good. You know, Leinster's the, you know, population-wise, the number of players it produces. And also, I think the quality of the players that have been produced there, there's no point in them not getting the opportunity to play professional rugby and have international players coming in to take those spots where we're shorn of talent. So I think it's been fantastic.
Yeah, I suppose my point was there was no excuses for Ulster in the last, if we take the last 5 or 6 years and how close they got, but there was excuses this weekend for sure. It's just one way or the other. It hasn't transferred into anything since what, 99? Okay, they did win a Celtic League.
They're far from the finished article, and I'm sure Darren McFarlane will tell you that. They're moving the right direction. Yeah. You know, the front five is the big area of concern over the last sort of 5 years.
Well,
maybe.
Sullivan's been the find of the season in a lot of ways, though, hasn't he?
He's done very well. He got caught, as I mentioned, 1 or 2 scrums, but he certainly, you know, stood up for a guy
that's come from nowhere, really, you know?
Yeah. And Henderson's performance, I thought, was absolutely immense.
Anyone in there that could make the plane, we'll call it the plane, there's no better term.
I'll tell you one interesting one, and it was a cameo, obviously, but to see Luke Marshall perform the way he did, even if it was just for 15 minutes. I mean, 5 years ago, we were talking about this guy as a banker for 50 caps, and he kind of disintegrated, and he's had injury problems. But I suppose on the back of Ireland's form in the Six Nations, if you know, on a couple of injuries maybe, and he gets a run of games, you know, you never know. You can get a guy into the shake-up there.
And there's been a lot of injuries in that position.
Yeah,
recently,
absolutely.
As well,
Chris Farrell, very checkered injury history as well. He's probably fourth amongst the centres.
Well, how did McCluskey do?
Yeah, I thought he gives something else. You know, you talk about Chris Farrell and his physicality. I think McCluskey is more that he was known as an up and down, you know, very hard physical carrier, hard tackler. But if you look at his footwork, he put through a beautiful little kick on the gain line, which nearly set a try up for
Ballacoon. This is new, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, his offloading game, he's certainly improved over the last season or 2 seasons in that area of creativity, as well as just, you know, a bit of hard running.
Which
on that performance like that, and sometimes you just need that. You know, you look at the likes of England and Wales, it was a lack of winning the gain line, just hard physical. And I don't mean just running at guys, but getting a soft shoulder, but having that power to get through. And I use Hay playing against tall centre, 6'3", 6'4". They can get their hands free. If they get a soft shoulder and offload, and you're put away. I think he certainly won. John Cooney as well. He should have started the Welsh game. You know, I didn't think Conor Murray was playing well enough. He'd had enough chances, needed to go back to Munster, as we saw him, his pick up his performance at Edinburgh, to not be in the squad at all, and Marmion come in. Maybe that was some Joe's logic of thinking towards the World Cup. But I thought Cooney's been the former scrum half in Ireland, and you know, missed a couple of kicks, but I thought he was outstanding.
You can smell it off a guy when he's in his pomp, can't you? And he just he's radiating that like, I'm the kiddie, I'm in the form of my life.
His decision making is excellent as well.
Yeah,
just on McCluskey there, when he was in with the Ireland camp in November, he kind of admitted he couldn't just be another centre. He had to have something that Joe didn't have already. And whether that was the way Ulster were playing, kind of more of an offloading game, you could see it from when McFarland came in, they were trying to play a bit more expansive and taking a few more risks. So maybe that's something he has to add to show to Joe Schmidt that I'm not just another centre, I have this extra.
Sure, I mean, if he's footwork offloading and the ability to throw in the odd cute dink, as well as winning your 50, coming out at least 50-50 in your midfield collisions, that was what was missing in the Six Nations as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, but Henshaw and Anaki are brilliant players, but you kind of know exactly what you're getting. Sorry, I know that Robbie was injured after the first game, but... Yeah, no, that was kind of McCluskey's aim over November to try and see if he can...
Well, it's interesting because what we're saying is selections are, that were kind of copper-fastened in January are now wide open again, aren't they? Let's go on to the Munster game briefly. And do you want to introduce what Conor Murray had to say? Because this is interesting. We're going to be chatting to Paul about his time in Saracens.
Yeah.
And
well, someone said that Edinburgh were going to try and out-Munster, but Munster out-Munstered Edinburgh. And Conor Murray...
Two clichés in one sentence.
There you go. Conor Murray was talking to Justin Tracy. Justin asked him if he thinks Saracens are the form team in Europe at the moment.
Yeah, I think they are. You know, Leinster are right up there as well. But I think looking at the performance Saracens put in against Glasgow, it's really impressive by them. And we know... You know, when you get to this stage of the season, you're going to come up against really, really good sides in really good form, sides with pedigree, and they've obviously experience of winning semi-finals. You know, 2 years against us in the Aviva, which hurt us a lot. You know, we thought we were in that game for a while, and you know they just pressured us into making a few mistakes and kind of got a bit of a lead that was too far to chase down ultimately. So, tough team, really tough team, and you know to get past the semi-final, you're going to have to beat good teams. So, you know, we rate ourselves. I think we're in a better place than we were two seasons ago. You know, hopefully it'll be a really tight contest.
Yeah. Do you have a formula? I suppose you're not going to tell us necessarily, but is there a formula to beating the Saracens team with the likes of Farrell and Williams? They seem really, really composed when they have the ball and very difficult to get the ball off. Mm. And obviously the break comes, they can, as you say, pressurise teams into making mistakes. They get the ball, they tend to score.
Yeah, they do. They tend to take a lot of their opportunities when they do get turnovers, or they do keep the ball for a number of phases, and it's really hard to get it back off them, you know, and they do end up wearing teams down. And like I said, they're a top class side, but sides have beaten them. You know, if you look at Exeter, you look at Leinster last year, you know, maybe look at those games quite closely, look at our games against them in recent times, especially the semi-final, and see where we came up short. Look at them enough, and again look at ourselves and kind of progress our game and back our game plan and our systems to be able to break them down when we do get the opportunities. So you know, we got to go there full of belief.
You go there, as you say, full of belief, and you go there thinking, yeah, a final is well within your reach.
Yeah, 100%. You can't go into these games and hope you survive and hope you get through it somehow. You know, you got to go out and play as well as you've been playing all year, as well as the team has been performing all year, and not go into your shell. And that's probably something we've learned from previous semi-finals. You know, maybe the occasion was quite big that you don't trust what you've been doing all year. So that's the challenge in itself. And I think we have a number of players now who've experienced these times and hopefully know how to deal with it.
Thanks, Justin Tracy, talking to Conor Murray. So, look, this time last year, there was no argument. Leinster were irresistible. Now, on the weekend's evidence, I know it's hard to get collateral form and all the rest of it. It's Saracens are the form team. A couple of years ago, it was home country advantage, Wes. Now it's travelling over there to the Rico and shortly to Spurs. We'll talk about that in a minute. I mean, I can't remember Munster being as, well, you know, written off as premature because it's still 3 weeks away. But, you know, you're a dyed in the wool. Sorry about that phrase, Munster man. Can you remember going over with less expectation?
Yeah, probably. Toulon and Claremont and semis like that. Probably
that far back.
The same thing, yeah. But I just, yeah, I mean, in fairness, I think they've been apart for 6-7 weeks with a core of guys playing with Ireland. You're coming back, you're playing a team that you're expected to beat, a team that doesn't have a huge name in Europe, in Edinburgh, 12:30 kickoff. Like, I can see how the game rolled out the way it did. I mean, and it'll be a totally different headspace going over as huge underdogs against Saracens. But I think they're the one team that won't be in any way spooked by, you know, Munster's reputation, tradition, travelling support, whatever you want to throw in there. And I think they're, if you look at their best 6 or 7 players, I think they just bring a power to the game that Munster are really going to struggle to match.
They're a machine.
Well, I mean, just the two Vunipolas, Jamie George, Crew, Satoje, Farr, Liam Williams. I know Munster have their own, you know, guys like Conor Murray, but I don't know. It's, if Munster were at home, you could make the argument. But yeah, I mean, they're very much underdogs, I think.
It reminds me of Saracens this year, remind me of Leinster last year. Just the way it, 6 wins out of 6 in the pool, comprehensive quarterfinal win at home, another home semi-final or home country semi-final coming up. It just has that look about it that it might play out the same way Leinster played out last year.
Yeah. Munster probably made it to a semi-final against the head, so to speak, a couple of years ago, probably very much fueled by the emotion of off-the-field events and under Razzie that year. And they consolidated that last year. And the talk is, what do you need to do to take the next step? That in these bigger games, they were caught there, how one-dimensional they were showing up. And I suppose with Joey moving down and with Chris Farrell maybe more embedded, the hope was they'd expand their game this year. But you just look at the players, the quality of players, 1 to 15 between both teams. Or equally, if you want to turn the clock back to when Munster did win a semi-final against a much less vaunted Saracens away from home in 2008.
Was that Quinney scored the try? Yeah.
You just get the sense that without a favourable draw, they're not quite a European Cup winning team yet.
And what about all this DNA talk?
I don't think Saracens will be buying any of that.
No, I know they won't. What do you believe about this DNA thing that, like, I mean...
There's obviously some reservoir of self-belief that goes with that history, but I don't think this current team have the same mental strength as the last Munster team that won a European Cup did. I don't think there's many big characters in the team.
And is that, yeah, is an interesting question of which there's no kind of conclusive answer, but is that because that Munster team was of its time? I mean, would they, you know, it is apples and oranges a bit, isn't it?
It probably is a bit of that, and I suppose everything in hindsight and you view guys based on their achievements. But I mean, like Jean Kleyn and Tadhg Byrne are excellent players in the second row. Do they have that aura or personality about them that Paul and Dunica had? You know, you go back to the back row, Leamy, Quinney, the man beside me here, his brother or Axel. It's just a lot of, like, even someone like Rua Tupoki in midfield, like, huge personality, like, really forceful individual. Like, I just don't think they're quite, they have that aura about them. And maybe it's something that only comes with time and with winning, and you wouldn't expect them to have it. But not to be, like, terribly negative about it, but they're definitely peddling uphill for this one, I think.
Yeah, okay, well, we bring it away from the brain to the body. The power, though, there would seem to be a bit of a power deficit if you take Munster, you know, playing excellent rugby at a certain level and you take Saracens on their day. Paul, what do you think? I mean, is there a bit of a power gap there?
I think there is, yeah. We saw that there's a hunger. Saracens last season without Vunipolas makes a big difference, two big players. Mako should be, I think, is going to be back in. You know, even Farrell dropping out and Good, you know, slipping in at number 10. Now, we had to play the last few league games there as well. Outstanding performance as well. But one thing they have in this Saracen side, which none of the other English or, I would say, French sides have, is the team mentality. You know, they talk about the wolf pack. Their defence is what won them the European Cups. Brad Barrett, guy who won't, captain, won't get mentioned. You know, the guy most likely to look the most battered man coming off the pitch. His defence, but it's, look, he's well past it. He would never have been one of the great, great international players. He had an amazing role for England, but defensively, he's huge.
You know? Has he reinvented himself then in terms of, like, he's bringing...
His leadership, yeah. I think what he sets. And one thing they have in Saracens, and I'd still be a member of WhatsApp groups, and some of the coaching staff would still be there, and it goes back from the amateur days into the early pro days and some of the more recently retired guys. There's a real earthiness there. You know, even the likes of, you know, the players they've brought in. Now, they did have Ashton, so maybe on one occasion, maybe not as much, but apparently he's earthy enough off the pitch. you know, the likes of Strettle, all these players, there's no egos there. You know, it comes from the top down, from Nigel Ray, who lives and dies, lives and breathes, should I say, the club, you know, so much so when you go pre-season training sessions, he'd be there with his family following you along. It is really, really buys into it, and that comes the whole way down. Obviously Mark McCall's done a great job in there as well.
How but it's the undervalued is Mark McCall?
Yeah, and it's very unfortunate when you look at
in this country when he left particularly.
Ulster, yeah, when he left Ulster and you know the threats he was getting and everything, it was absolutely horrid to go over there and have so much success. Now he had a very good team to work with, but you know it does seem like the likes of himself, you know Conor O'Shea, etc. You know you have to go outside of Ireland if you're an Irish coach. I think that's improving a bit.
It's that like we have he's the talent only, coming through. It's like McCall has just been viewed as a guy that continued from the base that Brendan Venter put in, that he didn't really establish it himself, and he's never got the credit on the back of that.
Yeah, Brendan got a lot of that, especially. But they even when they were in London Irish together, they had a very good working relationship. You know, he's continued that on, and I know Brendan still will appear at the odd game or two over from South Africa, so he still has a slight bit of involvement. But no, it's Mark McCall is the man who's leading that as
and,
well.
A lot of Ulster culture. Guys in the back room, or a lot of Irish.
Philip Morrow is there, and another guy. Is it JP Riley?
Kevin Sarrell is backs coach, who's been he's played with in Saracens, great player. Only a couple of caps, but again, one of these, a bit like the Brad Barrett, you know, a real team man, very into the club. The culture there is quite similar that you'd find to Irish clubs. Well, really.
Look at even in coaching terms, the impact they've had in terms of, you know, someone like Steve Borthwick cutting his teeth there, going off working with Eddie Jones in Japan onto England. Andy Farrell cutting his teeth there after coming over from League. He's obviously going to be the Ireland coach. McCall, Paul Gustard and the defensive system he established. Like, it's pretty clear to see that they've been, you know, quite a driving force in a lot of areas of the game for a number of years, you know.
Well, they seem to have that cultural sweet spot, which is, as Paul was referring to, the lack of ego combined with, I suppose, a bit of continuity as well. There does seem to be the same faces both on pitch and behind the scenes. And when you mention Nigel Ray, he's involved since 95, which we all know was the year of professionalism. You go back a long way with him. I mean, go back to your early days there where the model was to get the Castagnettis and the Le Croix cellar. I mean, unbelievable stuff happening in the late 90s there. Went off the boil a bit. But, like, they've always had some sort of vision, I suppose, for want of a more creative term.
Yeah, it was always the poor man's club when I went over. It was, you know, one season in the first division, then you drop down to the second division, back up again. Went professional, and was the year 1996 season. Arrived Michael Lineager signed, Philippe Sella, you know, two of the greatest signings, I would say, two greatest players I got to play with. You know, latterly Francois Pienaar was there, he came in during the season. But it was a shambles where we arrived over to. It was like a council pitch. They had this mobile lighting and we had to train at night because half the guys were from the amateur era, was still working in the city. So we trained Tuesday nights with the full-time pros, did the gym and the part-time.
This was Bramley Road days, was
it? It was Bramley Road, yeah. And that first season we played in Enfield Football Club, capacity 3,000. You know, yeah. It certainly wasn't that glamorous. But there was a great culture that everyone bought into, which had come through from the amateur players that were still remaining in the club under professional contracts. And that's continued to this day. And there's a real closeness from the amateur era into the professional era. The big move then was Peter Deakin came in, who had just created the Rugby Super League. He was Bradford Bulls. He was the late Peter Deakin, should I say, passed away a few years ago, but a great man. He came in and he brought the razzmatazz. And
which we take the piss out of about the fezzes, the disposable fezzes and all that. Yeah. But as you were pointing out before we came in, there's no central funding here. Like.
Exactly, yeah. So you had to go to Vicarage Road. You got to fill 20,000 seats. How do you do that? You've no core base. Yeah. And went out there. Now, performance has obviously helped. But a lot of it was marketing, getting out into the community, linking in with all the other clubs in North London. And, you know, we got there in the end and we had a very successful year.
Was there a big onus on the players at that particular time to help grow the club, to increase the fan base?
as well.
Big time, yeah. So it was probably only something that's come in the last few years in the Irish provinces. Yeah, you were straight off the plane in. Right, you've got a coaching session with this ladies' team up here. You got to go down to school here and do a reading session. So it was always in there, always selling tickets. You know, it's professional sport. They took this from, I suppose, North American professional sport, and we're always looking to grow it in that direction. So they've made it, and no one was there to pay the salaries except for Nigel's investment. So you have to try and earn the money coming in and to pay the players, and they did a great job in that regard.
Was he going to his own bank account more or less, like, and paying people when there was a bit of a shortfall if the overdraft limit had been reached back in those days?
Well, I think
whether it was allowed or not.
Never like to ask Nigel just how much he put in. I'm sure he'd lie to himself about how much he put in. All he ever wanted to do was to make it break even. It was a love of the game. He's just loves rugby. If there was anything about playing for your country, or if you're going to miss a club game, that was never an issue. It was always all about rugby, and whether it be the Lions or traveling to Ireland, there was never any issues with any national teams. About so you Polynesians
a,
as well.
You have a lot to be grateful for, I guess, when you look back on the key years in your career, 97, etc. You know that you had that backing.
Yeah, if I'd remained in Ireland, or a lot of the Irish players had gone to London Irish at the same time, I don't think they were half as professional down there. We had some good nights out when I travelled down from North London to see them there at London Irish. But I don't think they had the same calibre of professionalism there. A lot of it driven by the English players, the likes of Richard Hill, we'll say, who's probably not the most talented back row forward to ever come around, but probably one of the best. His work ethic, everything, and that drilled in. They performed every training session, every minute of every game,
which was new.
I played for each other, but also was the training off the field, the professionalism and that. And I think I probably wouldn't have made the Lions tour or played in a test series if I hadn't that exposure to playing at that high level.
Could you feel yourself improving week to week then back then?
We absolutely. Completely different level. We play Leicester Tigers, who are the core of the English side, and it was bigger than test games. I would have said either of us would have beaten Ireland quite handily then. At that stage, the top French players were coming over, the France hadn't established itself as in the professional game, and England was the centre of European rugby. All the top Welsh, Scottish players, everyone was in England. So it was a very, very high level back then.
Sure was. And right up to this week's announcement that Spurs new ground is going to be the new home of Saracens.
Well, it's more for the big games when they have it's a March game, is it, that they have London Stadium.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because Spurs have an artificial pitch under the ground, so I wonder, will they retract the turf and bring up the 4G or whatever's underneath?
Well, it certainly suits the way Saracens play when you look what they did against Glasgow, who are very good on that artificial pitch, obviously having one themselves. So, and that's actually one of the things I think of the Rico that'll suit Munster a bit, having them on a natural surface.
But just in terms of ambition, if you wanted to explain, ambition in terms of rugby and commercialisation or whatever you want, whether you're pro or against it, you can say that the fact that, like, a rugby union club is talking to a premiership brand about sharing a ground with, all right, sharing maybe as the poor relation. It just goes to show that the people behind Saracens haven't stopped.
No, exactly. And they'd love to keep it in North London now. There's a lot of sort of East London players as well playing. So that's the heartland. And London is, when you look at the likes of Wasps, who would have been in general North London as well, they've moved up to Coventry, basically. That they're the only team to service, that huge population, that huge area. Now it's very much soccer heartland, but they keep performing like that, you start getting the players in. One of the things with their new stadium, it is quite a small capacity, but they have been filling it out quite a bit. I think the jump to a 60,000 stadium to play more regularly is probably a bit of a jump for now. But
it's more of a Leinster Aviva kind of model,
correct, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, but just on that, the grassroots are very hard to kind of capture in London, I'd imagine. You are relying on your success as a recruitment for supporters, as opposed to having schools or clubs feeding you, supporters and players?
Yeah, well, there is a big link in with a lot of the clubs around Herefordshire, in particular when I was playing there. So there is a big buy-in there, but yeah, for some reason it doesn't have the, you know, it's not the big game, you know, in the Aviva having a Leinster game or Munster down Thoma Park. It's, you know, every Premiership soccer team, then every second division soccer team, everything. Soccer is just so huge there. And there's, you know, so much else to do. Travel, traffic, all these sort of issues. The public transport to the ground is quite difficult from the city centre as well. So all these factors make it a bit more difficult to get the crowds along to the games. But there's certainly, when you look at school kids, schools that are playing rugby, clubs as well, there's a lot there that they are buying into. But as I said, it's not the be-all and end-all of the sporting weekend the Saracens playing. It's so many other sporting options.
Sure. I mean, we have to step out of the bubble for that. Tell me, what are your commitments at the moment? Not in your personal life, but I know you have young twins, but that's commitment enough. But in terms of media work and in terms of... Well, start with media work, because I know you have a business kind of career as well.
Yeah, well, I'm not really doing too much. Sky have lost all the rights, as you can see, for Northern Hemisphere.
They went off rugby entirely, didn't they?
Yeah, well, I think it's when you have pay TV, it's fine if you're a monopoly. And Sky, their business model seemed to be that you have to make a lot of money from it. But when you get competition from BT like that, I think the soccer rights might have been the big issue, and you have to pay soccer to keep the lights on at Sky. And then, you know, where's the money to go elsewhere, especially the investment in the F1 channel, etc. So, yeah, quite unfortunate. We had, you know, a great rugby department of 40 or so people who... and
you did decade-long rugby,
all rugby union. Yeah, I would have started in 2003. I think I got invited to do an Irish tour to South Africa, which wasn't a bad starter. 10 days in Cape Town with just about...
It was work.
Yeah. So it was, fabulous time to work when they had all the rights and got to so many Lions tours.
When they decide European to get behind something, I mean, they spare no expense. But then I guess
I think they did an awful lot. I think for European rugby as well, bringing it all under one roof. And I guess, you know, times move on, someone has that. But I think what you were saying about it being fragmented, the Champions Cup, I think it needs to be centralised where people can go in and follow everything that's going on, not just your
home
team.
Those days were great, weren't they? The ones I don't think BT in Ireland has
the same traction that Sky in their prime had. And that's, even though it's not fragmented anymore, the tournament, I think when it became EPCR as opposed to the Heineken Cup, and then the TV rights were split, and now it's with a slightly less popular broadcaster, I do think the profile isn't quite what it was a couple of years back, you know?
Yeah, well, sure. And I mean, that's
And to be fair, probably...
More houses have Sky.
Also, though, in this country, like, it has been, the focus has shifted massively to the national team.
Yeah.
You know, there was a concern years ago that people were more interested in the provinces.
Can you remember that? Yeah. In terms of, tell me a little bit about the day-to-day other stuff that you're involved in. You're Dublin-based these days.
Dublin-based, yeah. Commercial property, debt financing. So we put financing together for shopping centres, office buildings, that type of thing. So based with a company called Burcroft, who are a small boutique firm based in London.
What does boutique mean? I mean, it's such a langer word,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, small. Small and good, I guess, Dara. We'll go with that.
Boutique
hotel. Yeah, it works. It works.
I'd like to be a boutique presenter, but anyway.
Brutal,
maybe. But what about the charity stuff? So, because obviously the business stuff is too boring unless you're making loads of money out of it. What to tell us? What about the charity stuff? Because I remember, was the Malin Mizzen, was that your brainchild? I remember your brother.
I was asked to be patron of Cross Cancer Research, which is cancer research at Trinity College and St. James Hospital.
You had a friend there, wasn't he, a professor? Am I inventing this? Weren't you close to?
Well, John Reynolds is the professor who's in charge of the whole programme. And it was Felipe Contepomi was the original patron. And after Felipe left, I'd been at a few of the lunches. I knew some of the people who'd set up the charity. And they asked me would I come on board. So I said, that's fine. And after 2 or 3 years of literally sitting on it behind and going to one lunch every year, I was hitting the 40 mark. I was away in Dubai with my wife. I said, I need to do something when I come back before I hit 40. And I said, it's cycle. I can't do anything. I have an arthritic ankle. So I said, what about a bit of cycling? I cycle in and out to the office. So I decided to cycle up to, what about Mizzen to Malin? That's a great idea. I think no one had done it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Many, many people had. The big issue was the charity back in those days. That was sort of 2009, 2010, maybe. There was the lunches, the corporate lunches were gone for charities. So to make funds, we decided we'd try and raise some money through the cycle. And I offered to do it, and thinking that nothing would come of it. And lo and behold, a number of people got the right people in, and we got to do it. So we've had a wonderful time, and we're still running it. We're 5th to the 7th of September. We've narrowed it down from 7 days to 3 days.
Okay.
You know, I don't know, is it the days or the nights were getting a bit too much to do seven back to back. So Westport for 3 days, cycling around, raising money if anyone's interested, crossrugbylegends.com. And we've had so many great rugby players along with us, you know, from, you know, Serge Betson, who believe it or not, was an awful cyclist. I thought he was going to be quite good. Sinsan Brooke was even worse. But we've had some real brilliant ones. Rob Wainwright, Shane Williams.
Were they on a tandem?
Mike Tindall. Betson and Sinsan Brooke. Yeah, no, he was. We were a bit concerned. I think. Anyway, we had some great cracks, and the likes of Mick Galway now, my brothers obviously as well, Paddy Johns. Those guys that turn up every year, and they'll do a day or two of it anyhow. And it's it's fantastic, great crack, and the same people keep coming back, and it's been very rewarding.
So no more lunches.
No, actually, funnily enough, they started doing a dinner now as well. So things are going well for the charity, I think. And maybe it's a reflection of how the economy is going as well. And
sure.
And also, we managed for the Irish Charitable Trust, we managed to break a world record, would you believe, the Saturday before the French game for over 40s on the ergometer rowing machine. So a team of 16 for 100 kilometres, and we broke by 24 minutes. So the brothers were involved with...
Had there been a pre-existing record now?
There had been by some rowing...
Prove it.
French rowing. No, we're actually going to get a world record. I don't know what you call it.
A plaque or whatever.
Well, not even a plaque, just a
certificate.
A certificate. That's the word.
Someone somewhere making
so, yeah, which was great. A lot of old rugby players in their rowing, and it was great fun.
And to add to your Guinness Book of World Records thing with three brothers on the Lions.
Yes, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I think we're just the only three still, but I'm sure there's another Polynesian family coming through.
Wes, we know that. Wes is the expert in that area. What about, speaking of Wes, are you from Cork or Limerick?
Cork, but I was just saying to Wes there, when it comes to rugby, I'd nearly regard myself as a Limerick man because I won 2 cup medals with Crescent, 2 Munster schools medals, so I've never been forgiven down in Cork, never mind
we can
in
leave
Munster
him.
Forgiven to Limerick.
We can leave him
Leinster.
Claim Cork as long as we get the younger one in Limerick. David is one of ours, I think we'll take that too.
Yeah, but your David's even politer than Paul, so he'll never accept.
He won't even answer. No. I've asked him and he wouldn't even answer. He's even been PC off the cameras with me about it.
Yeah, well, we regard him as Limerick anyhow. Sometimes it's sort of the outlier of the family.
What was that cup, those cup winning teams, incredible? Was that Nicky Barry's team or was that just after?
After, it was 89 and 90. You were Christians, were you?
Aye, it was nowhere near it, but my pals were 87 and they were beaten by Pres, but I think Crescent won in 88, did they? No, 86?
86, I think they won. Yeah, it was 82 and 83, 86, something like that, yeah. So, yeah, Nicky Barry would have been around there at that stage.
I never remember, I can't remember you doing back-to-backs. I mean, that hasn't been done before.
Was Bevan Cantrell, was he that team or was he David's team?
He was David's team. We'd have had Mike O'Mara was our captain. Billy O'Shea would have played for Munster out half. Some great players, probably didn't go on as far. Shane Leahy would have played with Munster. Philip Madigan, Lou said prop, Bubbles, Old Crescent. Liam Toland was in Clements, but had grown the whole way up with the whole team. But I went to Clements, so he never won a cup. So we give Liam a bit of a slag in.
I was in Clements. He was one of the few Irish schools jerseys on display on the wall when you were coming up long in Clements.
Did you have a Munster schools jersey? I presume you did.
I did, yeah. Funnily enough, I in true politics, I ended up playing for Irish schools before Munster schools. So I had a couple of seasons in the Irish schools, but I only got in after we won the cup the first year. So I sat on the bench for Munster and I got in the Irish team. That made a lot of sense.
Because we were figuring out here, I mean, you're like Charlie Haughey in terms of you get votes everywhere, you know? So you had the Munster jersey from schools, the Leinster jersey you played.
Not till senior. And I can tell you, when I wore a Munster jersey, I knew what it was like to dislike a Leinster jersey. So
what was that like?
Oh God, the change rooms are amazing. It's you try and tell the Leinster boys before you tell Munster, going, you don't know what they're like in there, what the way they view you. It was
not the same in reverse.
No, I managed to come off the Munster. Leinster never lost to either side in the derby. So at schools, 20s, senior, whatever. So that was one. A couple of draws, I think, along the way as well.
Did you ever think that because you, I suppose, injury cut you short a little bit, and then you see kind of maybe the way someone like Claw went on and swapped over sides and the kind of cult status he assumed in rugby folklore in the country, do you ever kind of think, bar maybe an ankle slip, that could have been me kind of thing?
Yeah, I was 29 when I did my ankle. I was talking to Mike Cross there, and we've been introduced, and he said, how many caps do you have? And he goes, to Mike, I have 61 caps, I have 46. And then I said, first of all, to Mike, I said, well, now, that's what, 55, 60 minutes? I reckon I have another 20 caps because we played 80 minutes for each one. But more importantly, I think Mike got his first cap when he was 30. So, you know, it just shows you as prop, that's when you should be maturing. I was playing my best rugby when I broke my leg that time up in Ulster for Saracens. It would have been nice just before the Lions tour to Australia, and I was feeling very confident. I was much better player then than I was 4 years earlier in South Africa. So I would have, if selected, I thought that would have been. Might have been my best phase of my career. So yeah, there are disappointments, but I was very lucky to achieve a lot, except for Ireland. Didn't really win anything with Ireland, but other than that, I had a very pleasing career in my early years. So I suppose just guys like Kieran Scally, who I remember coming through with Brian Driscoll,
who's always mentioned, isn't he?
And you know what, the two players came along, there's a lot of chat about Brian, but Kieran Scally was the guy who looked the part, you know, 99, just before that World Cup. Obviously Brian after that Tour de Force in Paris, and went on to be the, you know, greatest Irish rugby player in professionally or any, I think, but Kieran Scally had all the hallmarks of going the same way, and you know, there he was gone.
Well, kind of quite similar to Nicky Barry. I know Nicky played his whole life, but I mean, I suppose in terms of being that golden boy coming from school.
Yeah, no, but well, there is a lot there, and it's interesting. The one thing I've learned, especially over in England, that it's the talent to play, it's the work rate, it's the guys who do the work. It's the old 90% perspiration, 10% talent, and I do feel it is like that. And you have a lot of these talents that come through, but you need a bit of luck. You need luck as well.
Mm-hmm. You do indeed. What about, just to go back to the kind of the story moving away from the Heineken, what do you assess Ireland's chances of rediscovering their November form? Or is that even the right question? We're looking at the World Cup. I know it's 6 months away or 5 months, whatever now. I mean,
it'll be like a new season, Dara. It'll, you know, finish up. Hopefully, you know, we should have teams in both finals, Pro 14 and Champions Cup. So a lot of players need a bit of recovery. I think a lot of them will play themselves back in. You know, we talked about Conor Murray. I think Munster now, with the run-in, I think we'll see him coming back, getting his confidence. I think we'll see the same with Johnny Sexton.
Ireland haven't been found out by good sides?
No, I think it's typically Irish. We were never as good as we said we were, and we're not as bad as we think we are now. Sure. I think it's always somewhere in the middle. England were never as bad as they were when we hammered them in Twickenham and we played well. And they've shown that this year. There's nothing really, outside of Italy, any side can beat any side. It's in the home nations. And I think all sides, you know, Scotland in our pool group, I don't think it really matters that much, because I expect we should win the other games, although Japan could be quite tough. Who you get, South Africa or New Zealand? You know, that's...
Oh, everyone wants South Africa.
Might be I don't know.
Yeah, but look, I actually don't know.
Nobody would pick New Zealand over anyone else in a one-off.
You look at
surely.
The Super Rugby form at the minute. A lot of their main men aren't performing. And there's a bit of friction with their central control over players. Mm. Provincial appearances isn't as contractual as ours. It's more a good faith agreement between national and provincial coaches. And there was a bit of friction that they were brought back in very early. Some of the key All Blacks as well. So they're not quite going as well as you might have thought.
If you look how we beat New Zealand, physically dominating them, we wouldn't be able to do that to South Africa. Hmm. We wouldn't be able to do that.
We couldn't do it to Wales and England.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I think, you know, and we have something psychologically over New Zealand now. It depends. A lot of their great players, like Reid in particular, I think, you know, aren't where they were. I think they've come over that hill. Of course, there's still going to be a very quality outfit. But, you know, even if we were won a Grand Slam handsomely again, I would say 50-50 getting through to the semi-final just because of the draw we have. You know, it's a terrible draw to have the option of one of those two teams. Where Ireland are going to be, I think they'll be in a much better place. I think the home warm-up game against Wales should be a bit lively.
Yep.
Even if you're looking forward, so I think
live
we'll have
on
enough
RTE.
Big games.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
What's that? August? What is it again?
It's September 6th, I think. Maybe I think it's
is
into
that
September.
The home one is September.
Home
where do we go? So what's the running? I can't remember at this stage. Twice
we've,
Wales.
We've
anyway.
Italy at home.
Italy at home is the other one we have at home. Yeah. Sorry, my mistake.
Yeah.
Let's hear from Marius Joubert now because we were talking about South African rugby and the man who played. 30 times for the Boxes on the line, played with Claremont as well. Marius, thanks for joining us.
How are you guys doing?
Everyone seems to be in good form, and yourself?
Yeah, very good form, yeah. Following the rugby closely, followed the Six Nations very closely. Some good rugby up in the north. And then, obviously, our Super Rugby season that's kicked off here a while ago. So it's interesting, and interesting year. It's a World Cup coming up.
Are you scared senseless as a Springbok about the potential of playing Ireland in a quarter-final?
It's a tough one. I think we're more scared playing New Zealand in the first round, you know. So, but I do think, you know, that's going to be a humdinger for us first up in our pool game. It all depends on what's going to happen there. I think Ireland has shown, you know, they're number three in the world at the current stage. You know, they've beaten the Box quite convincingly in South Africa. So they'll have the confidence of beating us. But I must say, we'll be a different outfit when we come to the World Cup at the end of the year under new coach Rossie Erasmus. I think we've got some nice depth. I think we'll be a better side than the one that they played a couple of years ago here at Newlands, and I think it was Port Elizabeth. So I think Ireland is always a difficult side. I think they were a bit disappointing in the Six Nations, but still, they're number three in the world, two better than us, so it's going to be interesting.
Sure, but I guess amongst the South African sporting public, Ireland is not a scary prospect.
Well, if you look at the records, I think the record's in our favour. But lately, especially under the coaching of Joe Schmidt, and he was one of my coaches, you know, they've improved immensely. You know, so we won't take them lightly. I think we will respect them as a unit. But on the day, you know, I think we've shown that we've beaten Ireland quite convincingly before. So we'll go in with a lot of confidence. So Ireland is a quality side, but I think we are also much better prepared this year than a couple of years ago.
That seems to be the feeling. And there's so many ifs and buts. We're assuming we beat Scotland and we're assuming that the All Blacks beat you guys when the autumn rolls around. Joe Schmidt, so Claremont days, we're sick of kind of looking for new angles to, not understanding Joe, but I suppose getting some sort of insight into how his obvious and proven excellence will take another step forward in time for this World Cup. What do you think?
Yeah, I think, I've worked with Joe from 2007 to about 2011 at Claremont, you know. I think he's an outstanding coach. You know, we got along from the start very, very well. I think what made our side such a dangerous side in the top 14, a little bit less than the Heineken Cup, you know, we were a little bit inexperienced at that stage in the Heineken or the European Cup. But I would say at least in the top 14 is the way he analyzes and pick out the weaknesses of the opposition, you know, and identify that and working out your little game plan that you are going to do. And I think his attention to detail are extremely of a high quality. And I think that's what's made him just different to other coaches, you know. So the hard work he puts in, the feedback that he gives you, you know, obviously he worked more in detail with us because he was just our backline coach. Now he's a head coach. He's got a few more players to look after, you know. But I mean, I think if I look at Joe, I think it's the way he prepares. You know, he's beaten the All Blacks, and that's not just a fluke. You know, that's they showed the previous year as well that they can do it. You know, so you know they're going to be dangerous. I don't think we'll fear them. You know, we'll respect them, but we won't fear them. You know, when we play against him, I think he's very astute in the way he analyzes teams and find out your weaknesses and play towards that and to pick out that. But I also think Rassie Erasmus is good enough to do the exact same thing to Ireland. You know, so he'll be ready if we cope with the quick line speed of Ireland and we manage to handle that with a few kicks in behind and maybe turn them in the early stages, you know, frustrate them a little bit, you know, and not play into their hand. I think we'll have a good chance, but Joe will definitely be well prepared if it's All Blacks or South Africa.
In your days in Claremont and playing in the centre, was there ever a time that you kind of underperformed and then Joe came along and you did some work midweek and you absolutely tore the place up the following weekend and you were kind of going, well, Joe, why didn't you tell us that last week? Because, of course, we're all looking for kind of magic bullets here and we think, is there something in reserve that Joe has just not shown his hand about? Is he a master at not just deconstructing other teams' weaknesses but giving you... we call them power plays. You can use whatever phrase you want.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, he would give me feedback after each game. You know, he would sit with individual players. If you go a little bit into a bit of a bad performance, or if you had a bad performance, or as a collective unit. You know, so you know you'll constantly be on your toes. You know, there's never a time to slack out. I think you know. Obviously, he's a great motivator. You know, he's worked with the greats of the likes of Brian O'Driscoll and all these guys, Sexton. You know, it's characters that obviously, you know, way up there. So, you know, he's worked with the best and he managed to handle the best, you know. So, yeah, I think, you know, he always knows how to work with the players. I don't think the players fear him. I think there's a nice mutual respect for each other and bouncing ideas off each other. So, and even when I played, you know, he manages to get the best out of me. If he had to be a little bit hard on me, you know, he would have done that. And if he needed just to encourage me a little bit and give me a little bit of confidence and tell me that he backs me, then he would have done that. But, yeah, he's obviously, you know, been one of the better coaches I've had in my career.
Marius, I just want to ask you, because personally, from your own experience, this might be something that would apply to really, really terrible kind of time that Dan Levy has had an injury over here. I know different position and all the rest of it, but like a standout player in our Grand Slam winning team, and he's had to accept that he's going to be out of the mix for however long. In rugby terms, for him, I'm sure a lifetime, even though we hope it's only a matter of months.
Yeah.
You know, and I know it can sound patronising to give other players encouragement. They all have to wrestle with their own demons. But from your own injury, pockmarked past, yeah, any learnings?
Yeah, you know, I've counted the operations. It's been 9 to this date. So yeah, it wasn't easy. I think it's improved as the years have gone on. The rehabilitation, the support, the staff members that looks after you. So you'll be getting the best care. I think it's to look after yourself. Don't start too quickly, because sometimes when you're eager and you're young, you want to come back quicker than expected, you know. So I think you need to stick to the time frames that the specialist gives him. So I think it's a tough battle to fight, you know. And if it's against a race of time for the World Cup and to find form before the World Cup, you know, I just found that you know, when I came back, I made sure that I kind of not pull out of the blocks, but just ease in it, you know. So just get that confidence back, basics that you need to do, and build the innings, you know. Just get through those first 3 or 4 games, you know, and then you get back into the swing of, you know, because sometimes you want to prove a point in your first game back out, and you know, it's all about building that innings when you come back, get those 3 or 4 games under the belt, and get that confidence back, and then you'll be fine.
Marius Joubert, thanks for taking our call this afternoon and joining us on the RTE Rugby podcast. All the best to you.
Guys, great chatting to you. And let's hope we look forward to a great World Cup, and all the best with the team of Ireland.
Great. Thanks, Marius. OK, well, we'll end today's podcast by getting your thoughts, Paul, on Dan Levy's predicament.
Very unfortunate when you come back with such a, you know, injury prone at this stage of his career as well, and get knocked back for that. I think it's one of the areas that we've a lot of strength in. I thought Van de Vlaar was, you know, against New Zealand. I know Omani got man of the match, but I thought he equally could have got it against England, you know, losing team. I thought he was there. So having Van de Vlaar out as well is you know, two really talented young players coming through, and I think both have been missed. You know, we talk about the difference between the Six Nations and going into the World Cup, him missing out in the World Cup. But he is young enough, I think, to come back, and he will have it. But, you know, you carry a knee like that, he probably isn't the fastest number 7 around as well, so that might affect his game in long term compared to some of the others. But when you look at maybe the fact that Sean O'Brien hasn't really hit the heights that we expect for him to come back to, and will he get there for the World Cup? You know, I think he's a big loss for Ireland. But, you know, even in...
How does he cope, I suppose, you know? I mean, only he can answer that, but you're better at putting yourself in his head than we are.
You know, I only had one serious injury, really, which is my broken leg, which had me out for about 7 or 8 months. But that was, it's very, very tough. You're stuck in the physio room. Everyone, you have a team meeting, everyone goes out training, you know, the jokes, whatever, and you're stuck with one or two other injured parties training, and then they get back on the field because they're, you know, most guys are in for 2 or 3 weeks and they're back out again, and next thing it's another few guys that you're there, and you just feel out of the loop. It's like not being part of the team nearly.
Who do you talk to about these?
The physio becomes a very good pal. Physical doctors as well. The work you had to do, probably the highlight of my career was getting back from that broken leg. I thought it was the hardest thing I ever had to work to get back playing professional rugby again. My ankle was never quite right afterwards, but to get back to that level,
personal,
and the work
sense
I had to
of
do
achievement, yeah,
to keep going, you know, it was phenomenal. Like, it was every hour of the day I was either icing or getting physio of it, you know, during the week, just so I can get out for training the next day. And it's quite relentless. So hopefully he gets a very speedy recovery. He's an intelligent player. I think that's his hallmark for a player of his age, to be technically as good as he is, especially at the breakdown. I think, the one thing I'd be concerned for him going forward is, will he be able to keep his pace going with a serious injury like that, even at such a young age?
Okay, well, we'll leave it there, and we wish Dan Levy, of course, all the best. That's it for this episode of the RTE Rugby Podcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Paul Wallace, Wes Liddy, Michael Glennon, Declan Welly, Andrew O'Connor and Ruth Kennington behind the scenes. And we hope you can join us again soon. Go easy.
Thank you.